We quit. All this and more coming up on This Week in Retro.
High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
6502 powered a whole generation.
FPGA GPU for you.
And apparently 30 is elderly now.
All this and more coming up on today's show.
Up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.
Is this our last show, Neil? Are we quit?
Are we quit? Look, we're recording this on, what's the date today, Dave?
Today is the 3rd of April.
Oh, did I get you? Did I get you? We don't quit. Of course we haven't quit. We never quit. The show will go on forever, Dave.
It's the 1st of April, actually.
It is.
And that was our lame, pathetic April Fool's joke that seems to be de rigueur these days. It seems to be necessary to do a bad one.
I know how much you love an April Fool's joke.
I do and I don't.
I came across a good one today. I popped it up on Twitter. I was reading about something called Cyber Assault 556. This was an Amiga game that was previewed in the One magazine back in April 1990. And it told us that we would get, well, astonishing things from developer Bullfrog. Yeah. Where have we seen that before? Although this was 1990, so I'm not quite sure how much Bullfrog and hype were associated. Populous was out, but yeah. It was, you know, and it was doing well, but it was by no means the big Peter Molyneux hype machine that it became. So this sort of preempted that. Anyway, this game promised us 50 billion planets to explore, over 64 on-screen colors at 25 frames per second in a 3D world of space trading on a humble stock Amiga 500. Sounds great. Screenshots look amazing too. And it was a two-page spread they dedicated to this April Fool's joke, the scoundrels in the One magazine. And of course, it was all fake. But we were so full of hope, weren't we, Dave? I think that's the thing. When you saw something like that and you didn't perhaps fully understand the machine or its limitations and you'd only just got the machine, having upgraded, the huge upgrade from the 8-bit era to something 16-bit, you would have looked at that and thought, wow.
Billions of systems isn't impossible, because I don't know how many systems Frontier had, but why couldn't you just keep the procedural generation going based on a seed? I mean, it's you can keep doing it, but there was
I was going to say, you could certainly do it in a random manner. I don't know that you could do 50 billion in a manner on a 16-bit machine whereby everything was in the same place for everyone. But yeah, you could create an infinitely procedurally generated random star
system.
Well,
computers can't do random. That's one of the things they really struggle to. You try and get them to do random, they do a pattern that's just so complex it may as well be random. So that's perhaps why they could do it. But let's go on to the reply to the tweet. So there was a reply to the tweet from Artsui, and it looks to me as if the One completely ripped off a Finnish computer hobbyist magazine called, I'm going to pronounce it as Microbitty, and hopefully I'm correct. They published...
Microbitty?
Microbitty. Yeah, double T. Yeah. They published an exclusive, look at us talking as if we have the faintest idea how to pronounce it. If we get it right, it's by chance. Published an exclusive preview of a massive space game called Illuminatus. The magazine didn't exactly mention the genre of the game, but described its epic space journeying, trading, combat, and empire building elements. they solemnly described it as not only a game, but a way of life. And of course, it was an April Fool's prank, but it was parodying the unrealistic expectations placed on games in the press and the unfounded optimism concerning increasing computing power. Moreover, it mocks the ways in which actual games such as Space Trading and Combat Game Elite, which came out in 1984, were treated in reviews. Now, I take issue with that.
Go on, Dave. What's upset you today?
Well, if it's saying that magazines were saying there was more in Elite than there actually was in Elite, it's a subjective thing to say that. We're talking about the imagination gap again. Elite is if you really boil it down, it's a fairly simple game. But if you let your imagination fill the gap, it's wonderful. And if that's what if they were seeing behind the curtain and saying, actually, it's not that great when you look at what's there, it's all a facade. I mean, was that a thing we did at the end of the 80s, towards mid-80s games?
It was a five-year-old game by this point, so yeah. It was probably, you know, trendy to put a downer on Elite, you know. Oh, this is an old game, this is for 8-bit systems, although it came up for 16-bit systems. What does the future look like, you know, full of, like, say, optimism and hope and hype for the future.
Hype. Rise of the Robots, hype.
Yeah, but two interesting April Fool's jokes, and maybe the one saw that one on Microbitty and was inspired the following year.
maybe. What's the chances, Neil? Meaning 100%.
Maybe. So anyway, I mean, it's all slightly irrelevant because April Fool's was nearly a week ago, if you're listening to this on release, but it just didn't fall right for the show last week. So nice to talk about. Other things that have been going on this week. Thank you to everyone who took a visit to the rmcretro.store shop and bought a This Week in Retro mug. Do feel free to tweet us. What's our Twitter address? Where are we on socials, Dave? You do that.
It's This Week Retro, I think. Let me find out.
So if you want to show us you sipping from your This Week in Retro mug while listening to the show, please do share that.
At Week Retro.
The weakest retro show around.
Not WEAK.
And I've just added to the store as well digital downloads, so you can get the Retro Tea Breaks, the Hoffman, and the Colouring Book digitally or as a bundle. And I'll shut up now because I don't want to go promoting the shop too.
It's only a tenner. How's your week been?
Our week's been good. I'm a little bit tired today because I was watching the Revision Demo Party late last night.
So did I.
Love to catch that every year. Always slightly tricky because it falls on Easter. And of course, you've got family things. You've got other things going on Easter normally. So I rushed back last night to catch the Amiga demos, the PC, the 8K demos. There was a DJ set. It's always great to watch. The Amiga demos were quite strong this year after a week outing last year, so that was nice to see.
Yeah.
And I've been catching up on some of the others, like the old school demo comp that I couldn't watch live.
Not seen that yet.
Fantastic Amstrad CPC one at the
end. I'm always hopeful. Yes. And maybe this is pathetic of me, but I'm always hopeful to see Amstrad CPC and Atari ST demos in there. Did you notice a demo from our friend Terrible Fire last night? He's been telling me about it for a couple of months now, and seemingly he's unable to keep a secret because he's been telling everyone else about it apart from his friend Chucky. But yeah, he made a demo and it was really good.
It was an Outrun style sprite scaling road flying around with biffer bins by the side of the road.
It had a sinister, the music, the Banjo Guys, all these music had a sinister feel to it. I was really impressed by it.
Well, it was Castlevania cover, wasn't it? Or Dracula cover.
Yeah, but it had that. The whole thing felt quite kind of dark.
The music on all the demos actually was really impressive.
Yeah.
It just gets better and better. The techniques they've got for compressing, you know, complete, fully formed audio tracks into tiny amounts of code into a floppy disk. It's wonderful.
In previous years, there was a little bit of almost resentment at all the A1200 and higher required demos being in there. But now that we're back to a position where there's lots of good A500 demos in the Amiga competition, all of a sudden, no one minds. It's great to be back there.
It's nice to see what's possible on that stock machine you had back in the day, sort of as the default. And then it's also nice to see a few accelerated, you know, what can this be pushed to the max?
But it's good we're getting both now. In the previous years, we tended to see less of the A500 stuff.
Yeah. So that's Revision. It's still going on today. It won't be on Saturday, but you'll find it all over YouTube. You'll find it on Twitch. Just look up Revision Demo Party 2024 and you'll be able to watch back. And the winners haven't been announced yet, so we'll catch that later today.
Yeah, the voting hasn't yet closed at the time we're recording.
Revision, what's the website? 2024.revision-party.net. That's where to go. I will make it there one day. Good. Well, that's been the week. I'm going to sip some more coffee to wake myself up. And should we get into the first story?
Yeah. So, Neil, did you know that one CPU powered a whole generation of computers? In fact, most 8-bits.
Oh, yes. The Z80.
Well, that's what I thought. But no, it's the 6502. Now, Lord Borak has submitted a video from 8-Bit Guy, which talks about that particular CPU. He's managed to take what's possibly a bit of a dry topic and make it quite accessible without just going on about the games. And I think it can only be described as his love letter to the MOS 6502.
He is a very competent coder, as we've seen from the games that he's written himself. So he is well positioned to talk about this, isn't he?
He really does love the 6502. That's what he's all about. Now, I didn't realize how ubiquitous it was. So the 6502 or variant was used in the Atari 2600, the C64, in pacemakers, in satellites, in lots of stuff. And in fact, two of the original three home micros, that's the Apple II and the Commodore PET, used it. The TRS-80 used the Z80. It's clear he's a big fan of it, and he presents the video in a way that makes it look good. But no wonder, there's miles of nostalgia with that little chip. Its mainstream life did last a while. The Super Nintendo, for example, had one running at around four times the speed of the C64. But of course, the Super Nintendo had some really beefy co-processors in its chipset for graphics. And when you saw the SNES doing amazing stuff, you were really seeing those co-processors doing it for it. So unlike older micros, the CPU by that point was kind of the ringmaster of the circus rather than a one-man band like it was in the... more like a one-man band, because it wasn't quite exclusive that way in most systems. And just for the sake of being correct, I should say that there's lots of variants of the 6502, but I'm not going to talk about the differences because fundamentally they're the same technology. Now, there's lots more that he says in the video and I won't cover it all here, but what made me think about it is just how prolific the 6502 is. I actually thought the Z80 was in more things than the 6502, and maybe the Z80 had a longer life than it. But there's still loads of 6502 around. But of course, the elephant in the room is the 8086. Of the processors of the time, it went on to conquer things with its iterations, the 8286, the 386, 486, and beyond. So, Neil, do you love your 6502?
I do love the 6502, and I'm just looking here as you're talking about the availability of it, and I couldn't tell you if this is a drop-in replacement for, say, a C64 machine or not, but you can buy a variant of some sort of a brand new still manufactured 6502 chip from WDC, Western Design Center. That's over on Mouser Electronics. So it still exists in a form.
There's a few variants of it. I said I wouldn't talk about them, but I'll talk about them. There are a few variants of it. Mostly it's just a pinout difference, although some have had it. The VIC-20, for example, didn't have a hold call to the CPU, but later iterations of it did have that hold call, so you could stop it and use DMA for graphics, for example.
Yeah, you talked about we talked about a few things, the Z80 or the Z80 to our American friends. The Z80, 80. The 8086 you mentioned. Of course, you didn't get the 8086 without the 8085 or the 8080 or the 8008. You know, there's a lineage in all of these chips that goes back to the early 70s. In the case of the 8086, it tried to keep that basic instruction set compatibility, although a lot changed from chip to chip. And I think the beauty of the 6502 is, yes, there were iterations later, it changed, but for a long period, it was the same chip that stuck around and it powered so many things. Without the R&D of Intel bringing a new one out every year, the 6502 just diligently did what it did and worked. It seemed to be very reliable. It powered a lot of machines that for a lot of people were our first experience of machines. For me, the BBC Micro was probably the first I tried with a 6502 in. Then a C64. And a friend who had an Electron, effectively a cut-down BBC Micro. So similar experience. But to be honest, I didn't sit down at any of these and go, wow, it's a 6502 machine.
Because you wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know. It was just another 8-bit micro in a very, very competitive particularly in the UK, very competitive 8-bit microcomputer market. And you just wanted to see what a system could do when you sat down. You know, I wasn't a programmer, so I couldn't get into the nitty-gritty with you about what CPU was best per instruction cycle and all of that stuff. But I could sit down at a C64 and I could say, that's a damn good system. Yes, it's complemented with lots of custom chips, but it's underpinned by the 6502. And the C64, probably top of the list, probably the first one I think of when I think about this CPU, Dave.
Yeah, I should say that the 6502 is seemingly, it's more, it's efficient, the word. For 1 megahertz on a 6502, you need about 4 on a Z80 to do the same thing.
Yeah, because the Z80 was around 7, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, as standard.
About 4. 3.5 on the Spectrum, 4 on the Amstrad, I think.
What am I thinking about? Am I thinking about the Spectrum Next or something? I'm thinking about maybe some thinking kind of accelerated
68,000.
Oh, I am, yes.
8 on an ST and 7 on an Amiga.
That's where I've got that from, yes. Yeah, I mean, 7's all you need, really. You know, the extra one is just sort of wasted on the ST, wasn't it? Yeah, that's...
wasted on the Mac. The Mac had an 8 megahertz one that effectively ran at 6. There you go.
Anyway, well spotted. That's where I got that from. You've saved me a lot of comment rage going on.
I think you'll find.
My favorite, I guess, spin-off of the 6502 would be the Hudson Soft one, the HUC 6280, which is the CPU at the heart of the PC engine. So that was a 6502 that could run at two speeds, the top speed being just over 7 megahertz. So it's like a...
And that's why I mentioned this, the relative speed between them, because if you think of a Z80 running at 50 megahertz, that would be incredible for the time.
And that extra power in the PC engine really does show in the system. You know, it's a 6502 that keeps pace with the likes of the Super Nintendo and the Sega Mega Drive offerings of the 16-bit era. Arguably, the PC engine's a bit of a funny one. It's, you know, an 8-bit CPU complemented by 16-bit, I think, custom chips, graphics chip, sound chip, things like that. It's sort of a hybrid somewhere between the two. But again, at the heart of it, the 6502 in that form, and it's a real powerhouse. I get nostalgia for CPUs, primarily because you and I grew up in an era of code listings, and we grew up being told that this game is better than that game, or even this package. This office package is better than that package because it's written in assembly code.
Or this rail roaster simulation tycoon thing is better. Yes.
Yeah, this roller coaster thing. It's written in assembly. And that was the most godlike of programmers. You know, if you cut them, they would bleed machine code. And many of us promised ourselves one day we will get around to learning it properly. We will get good at this. In my case, it would be the Z80 because of the Amstrad CPC.
Did you?
No.
Did you? No.
But I still have that kind of aspirational attachment to the CPU to one day get good at it. It will likely happen in a retirement home. It will be the Sudoku of my time to keep my brain working. And I'm sure even more people feel like that about the 6502 because of the popularity of the C64, the Beeb, the Electron, whatever was your first machine. I'm sure there's lots of people out there who are thinking the same. So I'll see you in the nursing home.
Yeah, it's because it's possible. It's feasible with it. To try and then do the 6 to 68K, I guess, is as well. But once you start to go beyond that, the complexity kind of... multiplies. So these little 6502s, the Z80s, the 8080, it's possible to do it on those, or it's aspirationally possible to do it. That's why I bought the Aegon, because I want to do it with that. The Aegon's a Z80 and that. But go and watch the video. It's not just informative, but it's interesting. And he finishes off by talking to one of the designers, Bill Mensch, and he asked him why it didn't last long beyond the 16-bit era, because while you still get 6502s now, they're not as popular, as common as the Z80, for example. And he says in the 16-bit era, he was recommending ARM, so he clearly knows his onions. We are sponsored this week, thank you very much, by PCBWay, makers of all sorts of fabricated things like PCBs, CNC milling, 3D printing, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, although I'm not sure how much it would cost to 3D print our latest project, the full-size computer space over on the Arcade Archive channel. Worth putting a quote in, though. We could find out. I might do that once I've got the STL off of Richard. But something PCBWay.com have produced for me is the recreated Commodore PC20 system board PCB, which I'm delighted to say is now built, tested, and working. Thanks to the help of Chrissy and the board folk. So I'm looking forward to getting that back. I ordered about 10 of them from PCBWay a while back. They came in perfect condition, gleaming. So once I've got it back and I'm satisfied with it, I'm going to order a whole nother batch from PCBWay and make them available to others who need to restore their Commodore PC20s. So that's just one example of the kind of service that PCBWay.com offer.
Thank you very much, PCBWay.com.
We love a good hardware story here, Dave, especially when it's something to revive and rejuvenate classic systems. And we always get excited about the flexibility of new hardware that utilizes things like the Raspberry Pi, the Arduino, or FPGA solutions because of the possibilities that they introduce. You're not just buying the thing to do the job. You're buying a thing that can be flashed, modified, and upgraded at the software level to do things even better. Thank you, Gordon. We've seen it with sound cards, and you and I have mused about how that approach could be taken with video cards and other peripherals, and how cool it would be if you could simply change your sound card and your video card on the fly on a 486 PC. I think that's the dream, isn't it? To be using real vintage hardware with those mod cons that are completely seamless, don't dump you back to a modern desktop, don't break the immersion, but maybe with a driver, maybe with a line in AutoExec, maybe with a TSR program, you can quickly switch what it's doing.
Love
that idea.
So that exists already for things like the PicoGus.
Yes.
The PicoGus, the Pigus. PicoGus already has those commands, the where you can tell it to be something else like you would do on the AutoExec. So that's cool.
Yeah, you can put lipstick on a Pigus and it will behave differently. Oh, it's not called Pigus anymore, is it?
No, it's called Pigus to me. I know. for listeners, the project was originally called the Pi Gravis Ultra System to the Pigus. Which is where the snort came from, which is why the logo Ian's apparently calling Dave now is a pig after me. But it's now the PicoGus.
You've made it, Dave. You are. Got your own pig logo. This story this week was submitted by Dr. Local, and through it, we're kind of a step closer to that reality of what we've been talking about, because this is about the Fury GPU, nothing to do with DJ Chris Fury. The Fury GPU is an FPGA-based video card. Now, the article reads as follows. Created by software engineer Dylan Barry, Fury GPU is the culmination of 4 years of work that started as a simple project. Barry was interested in the idea of making a homemade GPU as his next hobby. I'd spend a few months making a spinning cube or something, and I'd be done with it, he thought. However, fast forward several years, and the scope of the project expanded beyond graphics demos and into the realm of actual 3D accelerated games running on his homemade graphics card. The Fury GPU uses a custom PCB equipped with a Cryos system on module that features a Xilinx Zinc UltraScale Plus FPGA chip. It's got a couple of video outputs, and this is on a PCI Express 2x4 connection. So this isn't something we can drop into our 486s at this stage. You know, it is a PCIe card. But it does take us a step closer. The power of it is akin, they say, to a mid-90s card. I haven't tried this myself, but according to the write-up, about mid-90s, and they say that's demonstrated running Quake at 720p at 60 frames per second. Now, you'd be very, very happy with that in the mid-90s. I'd say...
delighted.
I don't know if you... would you find 720p Quake in 1995 at 60 frames per second?
No, I'm going to come on to that, but I have my doubts about that. Yeah.
So of course that means it's a GL version of Quake. So to utilize the GPU, back then I was pushing the limits of my DX4100 and a slightly shrunk window in Quake to try and get a decent frame rate. Did play it all the way through, but I was happy with that software rendering. And then GL Quake came along later as GPUs took off, or 3D accelerated GPUs. It also works happily, this thing, just in Windows as your regular 2D card render in the desktop and all of that. So it's a wonderful achievement for Dylan as a hobbyist. The icing on top, really, though, is that he's releasing it as open source. So there is now an opportunity for those of us who are a bit more backwards to run with it, put it on a PCI form factor, see what can be done. I don't know about ISA. It depends what you're doing with it, but I'm not sure that there's enough bandwidth to really to push OpenGL or as you know, you're not going to really be pushing that on a 386 or an early 486. But perhaps this could be a PCI homebrew Voodoo card. Perhaps it could bring us 3DFX games without the price tag of those very collectible and therefore expensive Voodoo cards. It's open source, so anything can be done with it if there's enough enough interest there. So, Dave, would you slide this into your old slot?
Oh, yes, definitely. And reading through the spec and the speed it operates at, I had it down as something along the lines of a Riva 2 kind of thing. Okay. But the register says mid-90s. I'm thinking late 90s. I'm thinking to get Quake at 720 frames per second, you'd be looking at something from the late 90s rather than something from 1996. So I'm not quite sure if they made a little bit of a mistake there. It sounds more powerful to me.
I'm sure there will be someone out there who had, you know, money to throw at the perfect rig in 1995 or 1996 and somehow achieved that. But you're in the realms of, you know, hardcore hobbyists rather than casual gamer.
And when we're putting together retro PCs, we are often looking for that. We're looking for better than the period hardware setup. We're not looking to play Quake at 15 frames a second on the ropey Cyrix CPU we had at the time and we were promised was just as good as a Pentium. And it's not. We're looking for our dream PC to absolutely smash it at 60 frames per second and 720 FPS. Something that's credibly still feels like it's from back then, but with all the sharp edges taken off. And that's where these type of projects come in, and this is why they're good. Generally, you can find plenty of spares for PCs going right back to 286 times. There's loads of it kicking about. And I think it's harder to justify going beyond 286 to the 8086. There's not really so much that's compelling in the PC games arena to play. You're better off maybe in the Apple II. But what you find is you can easily find office PC stuff and the equipment that went in them. And you can easily find low-end, cheap consumer upgrades. What's difficult to find is the expensive stuff that was only in home systems or in high-end rare workstations. So the top-tier CPUs from a generation, the very fastest of the list of CPUs for a particular socket.
Yeah, the money is no object CPU that very few people actually bought. Yeah.
And Gravis ultrasounds and the better Creative Sound Blaster cards, and of course the top-end graphics cards. And that's not helped by seemingly worse BGA problems. So that's ball grid array. That's the way that they mounted these graphics CPUs onto the cards, where BGA problems, they didn't have it quite right, the process, and they eventually failed. And seemingly, the more powerful the GPU is, the more likely it is to have failed this way. So high-end cards are hard to come by. Now, that does sometimes mean that you go for a lower end of card from the next generation. And that sometimes is just as good. But this might be this might be ideal. This might be the way to get a very high end, real, in quote marks, graphics card from the era in the machine without having the unreliability, without having a card that you're worried is going to die or you feel inevitably is going to die one day.
And it does have applications for perhaps playing retro games on a modern machine. So, for example, if you put FreeDOS on a machine with a PCI Express port, you're in your MS-DOS environment, you've got a very, very capable but compatible graphics card with OpenGL. Does it support OpenGL or is it using its own API in Quake?
It uses its own API.
It uses its own
API. But he says it's relatively easy to translate them, which I'll take his word for that. but PCIe is good. I think it's good. I think it's maybe better than having PCI, or it's maybe not a problem because for the reasons you just mentioned, what we want to do is take the cheapest, most available old PCs that we can get and have them running as wonderful, capable DOS machines. Last week in briefs, we talked about a Phil's Computer Lab project on the Sound Blaster emulator that I've forgotten the name of. And that combined with a PCIe Pentium 4 or Core 2 Duo plus this PCIe card could see you having something that was natively compatible with all this stuff. And
plus free DOS. Yeah, it could be really nice. Yeah. And if we can find a DOS-like project like Exodos that actually runs in DOS, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be ideal.
Exodos is, but it just removes that layer again of Windows and keeps you immersed in the environment. That'd be
It's a theme that we keep bringing up, or certainly I do on this, that I want DOS games to be as accessible as possible because they're such an important, brand new, all these doors opened and all these fantastic games came out, and in some ways they're very difficult to play.
Yeah. And it just eases accessibility to these games for people that want to dip in and say, well, why do people talk about that game? I wasn't around then. And then they get to a point of, hang on a minute, what's upper memory? Why am I getting these errors? How do I run this game? You want to make it accessible and affordable.
A lot for a lot of DOS games, are they maybe the first point in their genre where the game really does last and it has stood the test of time and it's playable now without nostalgia? Is that why? I don't know.
That's a whole other can of worms. Let's not open that right now. It takes us a step closer to, as you say, choosing our ideal combo. Is it an OR64 and a Voodoo 3? Would you be happy with a Sound Blaster 16 and a nice solid 2D video card, nice SVGA card or something? I remember how wowed I was when I first fired up my first IBM PC compatible that I had, and I played TFX and I played Day of the Tentacle, and it was in 256 colors and it was just astonishing. Windows 3.1 was just a very weird feeling thing when I'd come from Workbench on my Amiga, but boy, the DOS games blew away any Amiga games that I'd been playing at the time. Maybe we're just chasing that feeling, Dave. Is that what we're doing? We're chasing that moment again.
Oh, don't.
There's another can of worms for you.
Don't take it all away from us. But yes, we are. The thing with retro is we can never be 15 years old again.
That's it. That's the problem, you know. Yeah. another solution, of course, is the Mr. FPGA project. And a nice, more recent way to explore DOS games is the 0 MHz project at 0mhz.net or z.net. And what that does is it puts a list of DOS games in your Mr. menu, in the main menu, about 170 at the moment. So you just choose a game. And it drops you into an FPGA emulated MS-DOS environment with the sound card in FPGA, with the video card in FPGA. Nice option. And people are now combining that with NFC tap things. So you've got sort of a stack of your Pokemon cards, but they're not Pokemon. They're actually game boxes, and you can tap them. And one of those 170 games and expanding, I'm sure that list will grow ever more. So if you've got a Mr. FPGA, just like the shop. So if you've got a Mr. FPGA, that's the way to do it. Dave?
I like that we're now in an era where we're seeing curation of retro libraries, because for the past 20 odd years of retro, what we've found, or what we used to get more of, was these great big lists with 14 different versions of the same game. You don't know which one to have. All sorts of games that some people will argue for the preservation of them, but they're rotten games. They were unfinished. They didn't put much effort into it, and they clutter up the lists of the good games. So I like that we're seeing curation in these things to make it easier to enjoy it. So I like that we're in that era of retro, and projects like 0 MHz and others like it are great in my view.
Yep, and it's not the first time someone's hacked together a DIY video card. There are other projects such as that by Ben Eater, which is linked in the same register article. The link is in the show notes.
What a great name.
Benita, go and have a read. And maybe they'll combine forces at some point and you can have the Fury Eater GPU.
Talking about Fury, play DJ Chris Fury's jingle for us.
We are now at that point in the show where we are deep in Dave's briefs. All of the stories that are not fit for a full chat, or we just haven't picked out for a full chat because we perhaps don't know enough about it to shape a whole story about it.
But or there's only an hour.
Or there's only an hour. So we'll start by welcoming new patrons. So if you'd like to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/thisweekinretro. As new patron, Richard... We don't read their surnames out, do we?
No, we keep it a secret. It's on the end scroll, but we keep it a secret.
Yeah, well, nearly said it. Your details will be kept confidential with us. Don't worry, no data leaks here. But Richard, thank you so much for becoming an official twirler. Dave?
A wee reminder that we'll leave it open. The question and answer session that Neil and I are going to do for patrons... Yeah. It's still open. Get your questions in before we close it off. Thank you for quite a lot of submissions. There's more than we're expecting, so it's going to take us a while to do that. Not quite sure when we're going to put the time in to do it, but we'll get to it. Thank you, patrons. And I seem to have inspired people to talk about virtual pinball. Sybil66 has submitted an image of his budget one. It's a 42-inch TV repurposed with an X-Arcade joystick. So the X-Arcade joystick is a huge, big dual-stick thing with pinball buttons on the side. And he's got another monitor up top. It looks pretty good, actually. I think it's the start of a project which he could add solenoids, etc., to give it the sound and feel of being real. But it shows... that image there, which I'm sure Duncan will put up on the screen for listeners to miss, will show how a virtual pinball table starts off and where you can understand from there where it ends up.
And if you're unsure about doing a project like virtual pinball, it's a great way to just set it up and get a feel for it and say to yourself, is this for me? Is this going to go to the level that I want it to go to, or should I stop here and repurpose this XRK joystick, which is a good stick, for something else, or this TV for something else? The more you talk about it, the more I'm tempted to try it out.
What about a cave video on it? Do you have wood cutting facilities at the cave?
We do. I did plan on doing one about 10 years ago because I made my mini gauntlet cabinet and I was going to complement it with a mini virtual pinball cabinet. Virtual pinball was a thing then. It wasn't anywhere near as advanced as it is now. So I could come back to that and I could have my mini gauntlet that I've made and some kind of mini pinball because I would want it personally. I would want it to be something I can pick up and put where I need it, portable, accessible, because I don't really, stupid thing to say, I don't have the space, Dave, for a gigantic pinball machine. Mm. It's not about the space. I like to have the flexibility to move displays and, you know how many stairs there are to get into the cave.
Yeah. I've been looking into it, and the technology is amazing now. There's all sorts of solenoids and little speakers and so on, and kickers and shakers to try and get. It's not just about a fast moving image in front of you to convince it. It's also about the sound cues you get and the feelings and the feedback you get from the table. There's all sorts of things going on there. It's really fascinating. I'm down that rabbit hole now looking into it. I've been speaking to people on a pinball forum. There's possibly someone talking about selling me one, which is not a stage I wanted to be at yet, but it's absolutely fascinating. And in fact, Dr. Local submitted the Techmoan video that we talked about last week. He submitted it before we broadcast last week, so he wasn't aware we mentioned it. But yeah, it's absolutely fascinating, the technology, etc.
Chris Walsh commented last week, stop roaning in people, have mercy. I'm sorry about that, Chris, but don't fight it, fight it, fight it, as Ronan would say.
Randall Hater says, great show as always. Where does the term Ronin come from? Or maybe Ronin. Is this show style English or more common? And I said I'll ask Neil to explain it to you. So, Neil, you have excluded our audience who don't who aren't aware of the UK pop charts around 25 years ago. Please explain yourself to them.
I'm not sure I am going to explain, Dave, because, you know, life is a roller coaster.
Ronan Keating.
Sometimes you've just got to ride it.
Ronan Keating was, I think, the lead singer, or were they all lead singers? I don't know. The lead singer of a group of boy band singers.
The worst dancer.
The worst answer. Is that how it works? Instead of getting put in goals because you're rotten at football, you get told, no, you stand at the front.
You stand, hold this microphone, yeah.
Ronan Keating was the main singer of the band Boyzone. So there was an annoying song that was overplayed in the radio that seemingly Neil and his wife Lily like to annoy each other by reminding themselves on, and they have called it doing a Ronaning each other. So there you go. Sorry if you felt excluded.
The topic of fiberglass came up, didn't it, Dave?
Yeah, so there's a comment in there from ATM9404, and he says, Dave says computer space machines are rarer and, I assume, more fragile because they were made of fiberglass. That's not apparently the case. He says they're more likely to survive because they're not made of wood, which rots. Fiberglass is more durable in terms of water resistance, and he talks about how so many wooden cabinets have all rotted because of the water or because of being in humid climates. And certainly we've seen that, Neil. You're going to say it, aren't you?
Well, computer space, originally the cabinets were famously made by hot tub manufacturers, so designed to hold water, as opposed to the wooden cabinets that, as soon as a little bit of water gets into the bottom, it seeps up, it sucks it all the way up the wood expands. It can be fixed, but some are beyond saving. Fiberglass, you know, that's not going to happen. And if there's damage to it, the way fiberglass is, you can sort of relayer it, can't you, and repair it. So it is a durable thing.
Yeah. In fact, there's an arcade archive video where they do a raid and you see the Star Wars machine and the cabinet just kind of folds down. It's such a horrible sight to see something like that just folding away because of the water damage. And ATM94404 says the reason why they're more rare is because the game wasn't that much of a commercial success.
No, it wasn't. It took Pong. The next game was the first big commercial success.
Computer space is better than Pong. But the world wasn't ready for it. And when we listen back to Ted Dabney podcast episodes where they interview all the old Atari people, and these are Atari people from the 70s and early 80s mostly, they often talk about how video games were seen to be a fad. It was going to be a flash in the pan and then they were going to be gone. Of course they're not.
Yeah, that's the Ted Dabney Experience podcast. Well worth a listen. Yeah. Retro spotters, have you spotted any retro in the mainstream this week? I want to know. I want to make this part of the show, Dave. You've got your briefs. I want retro spotting. Sybil66 on the subreddit.
He's a better name. Retro spotting is not good enough.
Well,
Neil's noticers
has suggested that we call this practice retronizing. Retronizing?
Neil's retronizing.
Maybe. We'll come up with a name. That means we need a jingle. I'm going to go into competition with you, Dave. Dave's briefs and my as-yet-to-be-named retro spotting in the mainstream. Of course, all of the spots this week have been about the new Ghostbusters film. Someone mentioned a Commodore PET. I think I saw a screenshot of a BBC Micro with an IBM monitor on top of it. And then there was an IBM, I think an XT machine spotted. So that's your spots for this week. I'll work on the format. We'll make that happen. Feel free to send your titles, suggestions, and jingles in.
The Guardian has run an article about more people not wanting to give up on physical media, especially DVDs. Thanks to I Am Amiga for letting us know. People just generally unhappy with the way things are and wanting DVDs for a bit of, is it certainty? Something you can hold in your hand and know what it is. We've talked about that a lot, so it's encouraging to see more people going back to physical media.
Well, another possibility for a slot on the show, does it run Doom? Well, Fskit has submitted a story in which Doom is seen running on a router. Yeah, it's been done to death, hasn't it? Does it run Doom? But there you go. It's on a router. We had a toothbrush recently. That's the latest one there.
I think Reese might be working on something as well. But I can't see anything's a secret.
Does Doom run on Reese?
Yeah, Doom runs on Reese. Reviews of the 400 Mini are coming out. The Guardian seems to like it. Coverage seems to be universally positive. And I remember this podcast used to have to fight the corner of the Minis against people who didn't like that they existed. It looks as if that battle has been won. People now quite happy to accept that, okay, it's not for me, but for lots of other people, it's an ideal little toy. But that is apart from the joystick. Senior Bai?
Yeah, like Senior.
Senior hey, Bai.
It's Senior yeah. Bai.
Let's not go down the road of doing accents, Neil.
There's nothing wrong with that accent.
Let's just know that there's a problem with the joystick. It's falsely reporting directions when another is pressed. And supposedly Metal Jesus Rocks reported that to the company and they said it's a feature. And I wonder if it's to do with a gating issue I'm holding up now for this a Sandman, Sandman part.
The problem, as I've read it, is that you've got the traditional looking joystick, and then at the base of the joystick there's a ring, which looks like it doesn't do anything because the original one didn't do anything, mm-hmm. but it's actually four buttons to navigate the menus, and one of them's to pause, I think. So it's very easy to accidentally knock that and pause the game while you're playing the game. There may be two different issues, but that's the one issue I've read about.
Right, so this issue is defective units. When a joystick is pushed to full stroke in some direction, an adjacent direction will falsely register.
Oh, that's another problem too. Yeah,
So that if it is that, then it's possibly a gating issue. So this, I'm holding up the camera there, a gate from a genuine Sanwa parts joystick, and all it does is it stops the joystick going in a diagonal direction. So you have to go up or left, and you can't go both ways because lots of old arcade machines were four-way, and if you did it in two directions, you did it diagonal, you ended up getting either one or the other, but not the one you expected sometimes.
Yeah, playing Pac-Man on an eight-way stick, for example, is very frustrating.
Yeah, so I wonder if it's that. I don't know. I'm just guessing. And it also reminds me that there's something apparently in Mister now to allow you to use an eight-way stick on four-way games and not have that problem. I don't know what voodoo it uses to do that, though.
Hmm. 8-Bit Do have released a very nice-looking C64-style mechanical keyboard, much like the Famicom one that they did recently. No doubt it's the same keyboard, but with lovely C64 styling, and I believe it comes with a little joystick or a couple of joysticks with it, doesn't it, as well? A little peripheral that comes with it.
Yeah. I bought the Famicom one. I like the colours of it.
It's nice. It's a nice presentation. They make solid nice products. Yeah, it is missing a numeric keypad, but then you might argue so too did the C64. So it's fine.
Yeah.
You can always get a little USB add-on numeric keypad if you want. I am still very much using my Amiga-themed, Amiga-branded Simulant mechanical keyboard, which does have the numeric keypad. I've got it right in front of me here for those on video.
Cherry MX Brown.
Lovely keyboard. But there are options out there. I guess the hobby is being noticed more and more and more by companies like this, by things like the Mini, by things like 8-Bit Do with their products. Yeah. It's a great time to be in the hobby.
Christ, if why don't you let us know that a 30-year-old menu in Windows was only meant to be temporary and it's still there. However, it's not quite as bad as that sounds. It's the format menu, and it was made in a day, so formatting disks or USB sticks now. But it looks like they did it so well that it was left in place, and why not?
Well, it's an interesting story. The guy who did it, there's a tweet to him explaining it, and he said he did it just in a morning. It was about taking code from the 9X version of Windows to put into NT, or the other way around, I can't remember. They needed a menu, so he very quickly knocked up that format disk menu that we all know. But he also talks about something that he set as a limit for the FAT file system when doing it that stuck around. So the whole 32 gigabyte FAT file system limit was a decision made on a whim, part of a decision made on a whim in that menu that has stuck around. That's how he explains it. I'm sure there's a much more technical explanation than that, but yeah, very interesting. Are those our briefs for the week?
Yeah, there's loads more. There's loads more in the subreddit. Go and have a browse if you want to read some stuff, if you want to kill some time when you're stuck on the toilet, or if you're trying to waste some time at work or on the train, have a look there. Submit stories to us. If it's something you want us to talk about, then submit it there. Or go and click the little up and down arrows to let us know what you'd like to talk about next week. Thank you very much to everyone who submits stuff there.
Thank you.
Would you say that being 30-year-old makes you an elder, Neil?
That's funny. When you turn 30, you might start to feel a bit old. But now when you look back, no, spring chicken.
No.
So it's spring chicken.
No, no. I'm looking down the barrel of 50, and I assure you I'd love to be 30. Bethesda's long-running series, though, has hit 30. And thanks to Christ of Why Not You for letting us know. Bethesda, 30 years ago, released Elder Scrolls Arena on the 25th of March, 1994. And since then, in the main line of games in the Elder Scrolls, they released Daggerfall in 1996, Morrowind in 2002, Oblivion in 2006, Skyrim in 2011, Skyrim in 2016, Skyrim in 2017, and finally Skyrim in 2021. And while I'm kind of joking, I'm also telling the truth. They did Skyrim, then the special edition, then VR, and then the anniversary edition. And I'll defend them here. It's a great game.
Why not?
Keep polishing it.
Yeah. And why not? Yeah.
That, of course, isn't all. There's been other games. There's been numerous expansions and DLCs, including the horse armor, but also some good ones. There's been mobile games, which I don't care about, and of course not forgetting Elder Scrolls Online, and of course the upcoming Elder Scrolls 6, which was announced in 2016 with no release date yet, although it's believed and expected to be on schedule for the new Xbox release in 2028. For as much as I think of these as PC RPGs, the success of them was driven very heavily by Xbox players. So it's time to make Duncan get the counter out, Neil. So say it out loud. What game's legacy was the Elder Scrolls following?
Wizardry.
Thank you. Just like my t-shirt says. And funnily enough, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, there was a kind of a changing of the guard in the 90s. The big companies at Origin fell away and new companies like Bethesda came forward. And Bethesda came forward with the Elder Scrolls games and then the Fallout series when they took over the franchise. And they brought us fantastic world simulation RPG games. You get lost in an ever-increasing depth in the world that they create. And sadly get a more console-friendly, casual experience as the series went on. But that's not to say the games are bad, because the games are fantastic in spite of this. They've moved forward in lots of other ways. So, Neil, have you played them? And what's the most immersive world you've been in?
So I've just been reading the reviews for Elder Scrolls Arena on Steam. And my favourite review on here is, I can't get past the first dungeon. 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
Imagine if they couldn't get it to load in conventional memory. They'll give it 11.
Yeah, and another one says, honestly, would love to play it, but my Zoomer brain can't handle this. So, quite a few comments about difficult and unexplained controls. It's just the age of it. It's just the age of it. Yes, in the modern context, it might be difficult to get to grips with it. But I'm sure if you persevere, there's plenty of depth to be had out of a 1994 game, Elder Scrolls Arena, particularly if you're a fan of the later games. I got on board with that particular series with Morrowind. So at the time, a flatmate, he was playing it, and I just passed his room, saw it over his shoulder and thought, hello, what have we got here? This looks interesting. So I got him to show me what it was all about. So that wasn't Arena, that was Morrowind. And I was interested, but I didn't really get into it at that point because I was already obsessed with another game that starts with the letter U. In terms of immersive worlds, you've been talking about getting immersed in these worlds, haven't you? That's really hard because it's not immersion is not entirely down to technical achievement. You can get very immersed in a text adventure. Of course, the imagination gap comes into play just as much as you can get immersed in a living, breathing sandbox RPG world. That being said, some of the games that I've got lost in are They're basically anything with an element of free roaming and the feeling of mystery or secrets to uncover that keep you coming back for more, Dave.
Yeah, I love environmental storytelling is apparently what the phrase is for it.
I love
the idea of when you're in these games, like Skyrim, for example, or Morrowind or Oblivion, and you're solving a quest in there, of there being more beneath the surface if you happen to look.
Yeah.
Little stories that it's not important or essential at all for you to know, but if you look beneath the surface, there's all sorts of other little things going on there.
And even
that stuff in the game is amazing.
Even more so, stories that don't exist, but you just convince yourself that they do exist.
Or little hints at them.
It happens in a lot of games, from RPGs to flight sims, where you used to get manuals with identification charts of planes that never actually existed in the game, but you learned their silhouettes just in case they ever popped up.
The first one that I remember, talking back to Elite, the first one that I remember was space dredgers and generation ships, which were talked about in the Elite manual. And you always wondered, are they in the game? Have I just not found them?
Yeah, do I need to search deeper? Do I need to go further into the universe to find them? And no doubt a catalyst for that also was the dark wheel. What was it
called? The novella
that came with it. Put even more ideas in your mind about what was ultimately a very empty game of space trading. But this all helped towards it. For me, the biggest catalyst for this whole feeling was a physical map on the wall, because when you're not playing the game, you look at it and you think, oh, I've not been to that part of the world, not been to that island. I wonder what's on it. How do I get there? And then you start to think, well, I need a boat. How do I fund a boat? What dungeons do I need to go to? What trades do I need to partake in to create something and sell it and raise the funds? You know, what's the quickest way of getting this boat? How do I get there? And then, before you know it, you're creating a quest in your head that is completely separate from any other objective in the game, completely needless within the game's mission context. You're just exploring, and you're just using the resources that are in the world to enable that exploring. That for me is total immersion. I'm thinking about it when I'm not in it. I'm planning what I'm going to do when I'm next in it. I can't remember the last game that made me feel like that, but there have been plenty along the way, starting with you.
Yeah, you for, let's not see it.
Ultimate Doom. No, also Midwinter, Hunter. Hunter on a much smaller scale. Mercenary, definitely.
Oh, yeah. That was the whole thing. So Elder Scrolls, going back to Elder Scrolls. The Elder Scrolls, Bethesda has created games where you can just ignore everything else and do what you want to. You can go places, you can find things you've not seen, you can speak to characters you've not spoken to before. Absolutely amazing to get lost in these worlds. So happy 30-year anniversary to the Elder Scrolls, which is now not elderly.
Time now for our community question of the week. Dave, have you taken the answers out of contest mode, please? Drum roll.
Oh, but I'm going to do it right now.
Duncan's
boom! Good. It's done.
And a hi-hat. Oh, no, a cymbal. Thank you. One more. There we go. Our question of the week last week was, what is your go-to most comforting bit of retro and why? Could be a game, an application, piece of hardware that allows you to switch off and just be happy. So now contest mode is off. I can read the top answer, which comes from Computerist 1969. My VIC 20. I fire that up and I'm 11 years old again, except this 11-year-old had rich parents who could afford a disk drive and a monitor. This is what we were talking about earlier, isn't it? Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah.
You can't be 11 again, but you can try, and you can do it in the context of being richy rich and having absolutely every peripheral, every upgrade possible slammed into that machine. It still won't make you 11 again.
The disk drives back then cost sometimes more than the computer itself.
Oh, madness. And then the disks themselves,
Yeah. Weeping Scorpion 1982 says the music, Mod, Sid, and MIDI through FM or Wavetable for mod titles, Pinball Dreams, and Fantasy's intro and menu music. The music from the Dope demo. Bought an Orpheus 2 partly to run on that one, and some of Jester's work. For Sid, I could go with many, but Rob Hubbard's Sib cover of Jean-Michel Jarre's Zuluk led me down the orally pleasing rabbit hole. I think he's made this deliberately difficult to read for me, which is Jean-Michel Jarre. And unbeknownst to me at the time, so did Martin Galway's cover of Magnetic Song's Fields 4 used in Yi Ah Kung Fu. Lastly, for, were these licensed, I wonder? Captain Blood, though, was Jean-Michel Jarre, the music, and that is amazing. That was one of the ST games that blew me away when I first got it. Sorry, that's not what Weeping Scorpion says. This is me taking over. Lastly, for MIDI, there are too many, but Dark Hall, so Episode 1, Mission 3 from Dooms, the first level of Descent 1, the third level of Descent 3, Fatal Racing, and so many, many more. What memory he's got. So yeah, I don't necessarily play the games or turn on the demos. I just play the music, and it instantly takes me back to the days of DOS and our Commodore 128. And now I will shut up.
Commodore 128. Yeah, he did have well off.
That's parents. A beast. That's a beast of a machine.
Gaming for me says has to be the Pentium 3, Windows 98, and Voodoo Experience. Anytime I want to be whisked back to the mid to late 90s, hearing the whir of the fans as the beast springs to life. All I have to do is hit the power button. Getting ready for some Unreal Tournament, Command & Conquer, Warcraft 2, Quake, or any number of games from that era in the late 90s was a true golden age for PC gaming, and one I always return to for some retro comfort food. My Pentium 3 system always sits at the ready. Great list of games. Warcraft 2 actually stuck around for years on my system, especially game. As a link-up game over serial to play head-to-head. That was really great. Unreal Tournament, Command & Conquer, Quake. Yeah, it's a great era. That's all three. That's our top three, but there's a lot more answers besides. Yeah. We've got Sonic the Hedgehog on the Game Gear from Rally, Tetris on the Game Boy from Jeff Mendoza, Colonel Mustard, My Comforting Retro Is This Podcast. Little heart shape. That's nice, isn't it?
Lovely. That's lovely. That should be the top answer.
Any pop out for you there, Dave, anymore?
Yeah, Richard Shears says, if I was to mention Blue and Orange, I can feel people sighing apart from the wonderful Pillock. And he's talking about Workbench 1.3. And he says, now it's time to listen to the excellent Twer track by Paul Leach again, so I'll shut up.
Yeah, that is my favourite colour scheme as well, the orange and blue of 1.3.
Oh, this is a good one, Star Trek Next Generation. Now, that is there's something definitely comforting about Star Trek Next Generation.
Well, Steve P. Edwards says Windows Notepad. That's where he goes for comfort.
I'm not quite on board as that.
We've got Jet Strike on the CD32 from Lord Borak. God, so many. I think this might be the most answered question we've ever asked.
I don't know, but have a look through the rest. There's go to our subreddit. What's the address of our subreddit, Neil?
It is reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro, where you can see the question of the week, you can see the latest show, you can see all the news stories people have submitted. Shout out to Dr. Local, because when I woke up this morning, I opened the subreddit and there was a picture of me as Pat Sharp with a huge mullet in the Funhouse. This was a 90s TV show for those who aren't from the UK.
I've not seen that.
There's breaking news. I am to reboot Funhouse. This Week in Retro reaches 5 million subs and sightings of the ghost of Chris.
Do you know, I didn't even notice it was your face on Pat Sharp's, because when you look at Pat Sharp has a wonderful mullet, but not just a mullet. He's got the whole kind of MacGyver bit at the front coming up.
Yeah.
And of course the twins. I didn't notice that.
That's I cannot confirm nor deny that I'm bringing back Funhouse. So thank you. Please head over to the subreddit to take part in the question of the week. Please go to patreon.com/thisweekinretro if you'd like to support the show. Please go to rmcretro.store if you'd like to buy a This Week in Retro mug or a whole list of other
mugs,
other merch.
Mugging us off.
Face on. And well, thank you so much for listening. Great to get another show in the can, as they say, Dave.
We're done. I'm waving.
And now we wave. We're waving. Thanks so much.
Have
a great week, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.
This Week in Retro was presented by Neil from RMC The Cave and Dave. It was produced by me, Duncan Stiles. The podcast version of the show is available through your favourite podcaster, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And the video version is available on the This Week in Retro YouTube channel.
Join our community subreddit at r/thisweekinretro to suggest and vote on the stories we cover on the show. If you watch This Week in Retro on YouTube, please give us a like and subscribe to help us reach new viewers.
If you enjoy our show and would like to support it, then please check out the link to our Patreon page in the show notes or description. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time for more up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.